Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those who are joining us live, make sure and stroll down to the bottom of the show page. And you can find some of the usual suspects there. Both Eagle One and myself are going to be monitoring the chat room. If in the course of the show you have a question you would like for us to address to our guests, or you just have an observation or direction you'd like to see us go, that's a great place to put it, and we'll try to fold that in as we go forward. And if you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up to previous shows, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes. Also, occasionally, our show will go longer than an hour. If you're with us live, it will click off right at the 60-minute mark, but that doesn't mean you've missed anything. If our guest is trying to flesh out an answer, or if there's another question we really wanted to ask our guest before they run off, we do have an after show that is recorded. All you have to do is pop into the archive, grab the show, fast forward to the 60-minute mark, and you can pick up exactly what you missed there. Now let's get on with the show. Unlike your host, back when I was transitioning from lieutenant to lieutenant commander, in spite of a few months of Desert Storm and a couple of days of Desert Fox, my career at the 10 to 12 year mark was one of a time of relative peace. People who today find themselves as senior or single lieutenants, if you deployed enough, single or senior lieutenants or junior lieutenant commanders, they've had a distinctly different experience. Theirs has been a continuous period of what I still continue to call the Long War. And our guest for the full hour to discuss part of that cohort of the Navy and Marine Corps leadership, their journeys, acts, and experiences, specifically with the United States Naval Academy Class 2002, will be Graham Plaster. He is a member of the aforementioned class and is one of the editors of the new book, In the Shadow of Greatness, Voices of Leadership, Sacrifice, and Service from America's Longest War. Graham, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks a lot, Sal. I'm glad and honored to be on the show.
Perfect. Hey, and just to start things off, wonder if you could take a moment and describe for us where the title Shadow of Greatness comes from and what was the genesis that started the book?
Sure. 3 years ago, the class leadership, headed by our class president, Joshua Welly, came up with the idea that we should try to gather together a bunch of stories focusing on leadership, but remembering the impact of 9/11 and talking about some of the experiences that happened in the decade that followed. Since we were the first Naval Academy class to graduate following 9/11, we were a class that entered the Naval Academy in one context and graduated into a very different context. So we had an interesting story that really needed to be told. Against the backdrop of a lot of other war stories that are being told, we thought that we could tell it as a team and as a class and provide a lot of first-person accounts from different angles and kind of flesh out what's been going on and bridge some of the gap between, you know, the civilian and the military perspective. And the title, actually, I had the opportunity to suggest this title, and we were batting around some of the common themes that were emerging in the stories, because initially we allowed people to write fairly freely. We said, you know, what do you want to write about? If you were to stand before an eighth grade class and tell them about leadership lessons and experiences in the last 10 years, what would you share with them? And, you know, we have people writing in from every different community and several different services, and they were sharing a lot of things. And we said, well, what's the thread here? And I said, well, you know, we were all inspired to join the military in the first place. And that's pretty interesting because you have, you know, when we were in high school, you had the Generation Xers, and you had on the horizon, you had the Millennials, and we had a general vibe of deadbeats, you know, kids that want to play video games and not do anything serious. But the reality is, if you're the type of person who joined the military or applied to a service academy, then you had an aspiration. And for us, there was an aspiration to live up to some of the great legacies of veterans that have gone before us. And we reach all the way back to the Greatest Generation. Both my grandfathers were veterans of World War II, one in Italy and one in the Pacific. And I grew up in a family that revered that service and looked to World War II as the epitome of a war between good and evil. And so as we went to the Naval Academy, I think a lot of us, myself included, had ideals about what it meant to fight in a war. And when 9/11 occurred and the war on terror was framed for us as we went to the graduation day and Vice President Dick Cheney spoke about a war on terror, we had before us a clear black and white mission. But as the decade progressed, we had a lot of learning to do, learning on the job, and I think that in the shadow of greatness is about a number of different types of shadows. It's about the shadow that was cast by the Greatest Generation and the veterans that have gone before us. It's about the shadows that we dealt with in the last decade to try to grapple with becoming great and doing great things ourselves. And the attempt and the desire, despite our economic troubles and certain issues now, to cast our own shadow and do something great for America in the future. Because I would say that we as a generation and as a class believe that America will continue to be great and has enduring qualities of greatness, and that we really want to continue to lead in that new America.
As I was reading the book, I was struck by the fact that you it's organized along certain lines that are pretty subtle in some ways. I mean, you've got it. I think the titles are, you know, the categories of under fire at the academy, and then it goes as it progresses through the book. You hit different topics, but underlying all that is a different. Speaking of shadows, there's a different structure that has to do with the lessons learned by people in the first 10 years of their service. Things like integrity and selflessness and duty. Could you kind of run over how you tried to structure the book in your editing to touch on those different subjects?
Sure. Yeah, we started out with, like I said, kind of a broad approach to just allowing people to kind of almost therapeutically write about their experiences. And at the same time, we had established certain buckets, leadership themes of sacrifice, service, selflessness. And so as stories were coming in, we were trying to categorize them into those kind of buckets. And then also we were trying to get a good selection of different perspectives, professional perspectives. And what we saw was that, of course, certain types of writers were a little hesitant to write all the Navy SEALs that we approached from our class to write. None of them were willing to write. And it's an interesting footnote when we look at the fact that right now on Amazon in the veterans books section, we're right behind No Easy Day. We're number two, and No Easy Day is, I'm sure it's an interesting read, but none of the Navy SEALs in our class are willing to contribute to our book for a reason. The structure, as you see it now, was changed a little bit right before we went to press because we wanted to get a little bit away from some of the narrow thematic buckets that we were working towards. And so we kind of steer a little bit more towards a chronological approach with an introduction to the Naval Academy and 4 years by the Bay and what the curriculum includes. And then we came back around to some of our leadership categories. Leadership Laboratory, the Naval Academy, talks about some of the specific leadership traits that were picked up and learned at the Naval Academy. And then Courage Under Fire, Part 3, talks about different leadership aspects that were learned in the field. And then Beyond Battlefield Bullets, Part 4, talks about different leadership and qualities of heroism that we were able to learn beyond the field of battle. So certain chapters deal with humanitarian service and tsunami relief and getting away from the flying bullets. And then we also talk about life after the military. A number of our classmates got out early because we were a class that had an option right around the five-year mark actually to get out even before the end of service. So some people did that, and some people after their initial commitment got out. And so we got some stories from them. And then we had some kind of vision casting chapters at the end talking about what's next.
I just got through reading a book, quasi-unrelated to what we're talking about right now, on the Mayflower and the early experiences in New England. And one thing they went into towards the end is they talked about King's Philip's War, which was a war against the colonies of Massachusetts and the American Indian tribes in the area. And they talked about the loss rate, rather unexpected for these people that came over to start a colony, much higher than anything experienced even in our Civil War, much less the Revolutionary War and World War II. And there does come a time sometimes where history will tap a cohort on the shoulder and tell them it's your turn. What are some of the statistics about the class of 2002 and their service in the last decade that some people might find interesting?
Statistics? Numbers, I'm not sure I have numbers for you, but I can tell you anecdotally that
sure.
we were a class that gave up some of our own. The book talks about some of our fallen heroes. We were a class that we were a generation that I won't actually just say our class, but we're seeing the integration of women onto the submarines and the acceptance of open homosexuality in the military, and the book deals with those types of things. So we're seeing some cultural shifts, and we're a class that, like I said initially, I went to the Naval Academy before 9/11 and graduated immediately following 9/11. So I think those types of things have shaped us and make us a little unique.
As I was reading it, and having graduated from college in the dark ages, but during the Vietnam War, people, I too am of a generation that graduated commissioned and went to war, although not a war that we look back particularly fondly on. But I was struck by the ambition that you all showed to write to conceive this book and to put it down, these thoughts on paper, after what I consider to be a relatively short period of exposure. 10 years to me is no longer seems that long a time. But is there a plan as you look forward to following up this book later on as people learn more life lessons and lessons from being out in the field?
We do, yeah. This past week, ending yesterday, was what we call Patriot Week. It was an attempt to try to push the book out very quickly to a larger audience. So what we did was we partnered with a number of different veteran nonprofits. They're all listed on the website, shadowofgreatness.com. And we used the partnership to help get the title out to their constituencies, and also we had a great national book launch at the Navy Memorial in D.C. on 9/11, and the crux of that was really to talk about the book being the start of something. It was something that we've only seen the first 10 years, so what's the next decade going to look like? And so Josh Welly, the class president, spoke about that. We had Lisa Freeman, the mother of one of our classmates who was killed in action, who she heads up the Matthew Freeman Project. And she spoke and got a standing ovation at the book launch. And we acknowledged the other veteran nonprofits. And what we talked about was, okay, the book's done. What next? And I think what we're talking about now is trying to push it more towards kind of a movement, and also trying to figure out how to work as a collaborative, you know, conduit between the different veteran nonprofits that are doing great things. So Patriot Week 2012 was this year, and I think we'll look forward to Patriot Week 2013 to do even more using the book as the catalyst. We actually received about 100 entries for the book, and the book only contains 33. Now, another 30 of them that did get edited to a readable version are available, I think, today or yesterday, maybe even on Kindle. So there's a lot more stories that are being shared besides what's in the hardback. And so we're excited about that. And what I would like to see, because I'm helping out with the social media campaign for it, what I would see is a conversation, especially going into Veterans Day and the election cycle, a conversation about cherishing what makes America great. And so we have a hashtag on our Twitter feed, #AmericaGreat, trying to ask that question to people and trying to stoke a little bit of the patriotic when we get people kind of talking about that. And it's interesting, I started a TED conversation. If you go to the website for TED Talks, I went into the TED conversation page and posed that question. I said, what makes America great? And right now you'll encounter, certainly in certain segments more prevalently, but right now you'll encounter a lot of people who are not too eager to talk about the greatness of America. I think we're pretty humbled right now because of our economic situation. And on top of that, there are just a number of critics who would just like to talk about how America's really failed. And I think the book is a great counterweight to that perspective. I think the optimism is still there for a lot of our class, you know, that went to the Naval Academy because of the crisp blue and white and graduated into a time of war, perhaps went through some ups and downs and, you know, experienced some deglamorization. Yet at the same time, I think in the process of writing the book, we stoked the fire of the patriotism and came back around to the first love. And and now we want to use the book as, like I said, a counterweight in the discussion, the national discussion about what makes America great. And the book doesn't argue about American exceptionalism. You know, we don't try to be political. In fact, the book is apolitical. There are voices on both sides of a lot of different issues in the book. And we make sure that we keep our perspective, you know, as far as honoring the Commander in Chief and keeping politics out of the book. And so I think that, you know, there's a lot to offer from the book that moving forward we can use as fodder for discussion.
Yeah, Graham, if I could offer you one little piece of advice of somebody who's fought the battle a few times, I found it interesting. I know where you're coming from, where sometimes in a conversation about American exceptionalism, you'll find people who, in my opinion, are just intellectual trolls who try to make American exceptionalism political. There's nothing political about American exceptionalism. I don't care if you are a Bernie Sanders socialist or you're a, you know, Strom Thurmond Dixiecrat. In that huge left-to-right political spectrum in this country, everybody has an American exceptionalism story. I would offer to you the people who try to make that American exceptionalism political, they're in their own little corral, so to speak. So, yeah, keep pushing the American exceptionalism, because I think everybody in that political spectrum should be comfortable with, and if they're not, that's their problem, not yours. But that wasn't my question to you. That's just one of my bugbears that I like to pull out now and then. I found it really interesting where you said that you had 100 entries and you had to, you know, identify 33 of your favorite children in order to get them published. And one thing that I've been involved with, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, as people have reached out to me, because I happen to be, I think most bloggers will find people like this, And I found other people who are in similar challenges who are trying to get more conversations out there. And you talked about a national conversation, but in order to have an effective conversation, you've got to have more voices out there. And one of the challenges, I think we can all understand why SEALs and perhaps some other specialty areas would be hesitant to write, but in general amongst junior officers up through commander and captains even, there's a hesitancy to write. And obviously to put this together and to get the right coal that you needed, you had to go out and really ask some people who aren't writers to contribute. What common pushback did you get from people who may have had a story to write but were hesitant to write? And did you have some tools or some hooks or some ways that you could motivate these people to get their stories out, which if they don't tell, nobody will ever hear?
Yeah, that was a part of this that I was really involved with because we're mid-career officers. So, you know, some of the most interesting stories, maybe even the most valuable stories, cannot be told at this point. They have to be saved for the memoirs. You know, for me, as a SWO for the first 6 or 7 years of my career before I switched over to foreign area officer, you know, I had some ups and I had some downs. I looked at some great leaders. I looked at some leaders that I had a hard time respecting. And, you know, when the offer was made to me, say, hey, Graham, write some of your thoughts down. You know, I had to cycle through a lot of different things that maybe I thought would make a great read or maybe some great life lessons that I just did not want to publish. And I think everybody else in my class went through the same thing because they said, you know, there are going to be some implications if we publish. You know, we're going to have to live with it. And we need to take heed what we say to our seniors, you know, and we need to respect our chain of command. But at the same time, we think we can do this in a way that, you know, speaks truth to power, and we can do this in a way that cultivates that national conversation. So, you know, I got involved early in order to stoke that fire and get people involved and articulate what exactly we were doing. And we had a lot of entries that were, you know, disgruntled and unformulated and, you know, kind of drifted a little bit. And I said, look, what I'm seeing here to the editorial team, I said, what I'm seeing here is people need to write. They need to write because they have some things that they need to flesh out, and maybe we won't publish all of them. We'll publish the ones that, you know, turn out to be a finished product and helpful to the conversation. And some of them we'll just turn back around to the person and say, hey, thanks for your submission. We really appreciate that you wrote, and, you know, we validate all of your thoughts, and keep writing, and maybe 10 years from now, you know, we'll be on a third or fourth printing, and we'll want to include more. But the process of writing and editing, I think, has been a healthy thing for our class, and I think would be a healthy thing for anybody who's been fighting for the last 10 years and involved with the war, because it's been a shadowy kind of war. I mean, there's been so much going on and so many different twists and turns that, as we see with guys who struggle with PTSD and just trying to transition from the military to the civilian world and the homeless veterans, you know, we see a lot of people that have a hard time processing everything that's going on. So I think the act of writing, and I was an English major, I think the act of writing is the act of thinking. It helps us think through things. When we sit down and put pen to paper or type something out, it helps us to process things. And also the act of editing helps us process things. It helps us, you know, to systematically have a conversation about things. So, you know, for me, it was helpful for me to write and then be edited. It was helpful for me to edit what other people have written and discuss it with them. And for those who still are not at a place where they can write just because of, you know, where they are in their career or emotionally, you know, I will continue to encourage them to write in the future. And there are so many different fora for that, you know, between blogs and just private newsletters and things. So I think it's healthy. And I think, and you'll hear that prevalently from Lisa Freeman, you know, the mother of Matt Freeman and others who used this as an opportunity to process some of the things that have happened. She spoke really powerfully at the book launch about how in 2010 she was just raw. She lost her son, and she was not really in a place where she wanted to take a lot of editing on what she'd written. And our only objective with working with her entry was just to make it the best possible for the book. And so we had some professional editors that worked with her and everything. And when it was all said and done, you know, she wrote us a letter just saying, this is an outstanding thing for me. It was an outstanding thing for the Matt Freeman Project. And when she spoke really strongly. So I think it was a really good thing, the writing process.
Yeah, even after all the years it's been since I both retired and was an active SWO, there are tales from my shipboard duty that I have been reluctant and probably will be long reluctant to write down because they were so bizarre that even looking back on them, I wonder whether if I put them down, what am I opening myself up to? But that cuts to my question, which is I was amazed going through some of the SWO stories, which of course I'm more familiar with, and some of the aviation ones, which I'm slightly familiar with because my son's a naval aviator, but how universal these experiences were. I mean, the very first entry was a young officer describing a mess he got into on a bridge, and almost every SWO I know has been in there. How much of an effort did you all have to make, if any, to find this, what you thought were experiences that almost everybody who'd ever served could identify with?
Well, like I said, we had 100 entries. We edited it down to 63, 33 of which are in the book. And in some cases, there was, some overlap. You'll notice that my chapter entitled Military Diplomats, it talks a little bit about my experience working with the United Nations from an operational perspective. And then Dave Augustin's chapter is about being actually a UN peacekeeper under the same organization, but a couple of years earlier. So there's overlap between the different ones. And what's kind of neat is, it's like, splinters of glass. They're all different kind of perspectives, but a lot of them are, coming from the initial pain, if you will. And no double entendre intended, but, we did also suffer together at the Naval Academy, and there's some suffering that we share. And the SWO experience is bread and butter for the Navy. So, that one is in the front of the book for a reason. It encapsulates so much of what you experience, what I experience as a SWO. And so we wanted to capture some of that common experience, but we also wanted to capture some of the unique stuff. So the book has a lot of what we would consider universals, and then also some things that are really unique about our class and our experience.
Graham, you're an FAO, but if you look at your other four editors, which as a bookie guy, I'd love to talk about how the four of y'all work together, but we'll do that over a beer sometime. Joshua and Catherine served in Afghanistan, as I did, and as a lot of people have, in very much non-Navy roles. And there's what I sarcastically started to call the plastic joint of previous generations, and mine and younger mostly, that did the joint in a CD. They got their joint credit and off and running. But in the last 10 years, whether they've gotten credit or not, we have seen a generation of leaders in the Navy and the Marine Corps, of course, who have legitimate joint, who have walked around in DCUs, nowhere near the Navy, not just joint experience, but in-depth combined experience, working with NGOs, IOs, various other organizations. The previous generations, except for maybe the civil affairs people in Vietnam, really haven't. How do you think this is going to impact the culture of our Navy going forward when you see even the senior of that cohort, those people who commanded PRTs in Afghanistan, most of them are now finishing up major command at sea and are lining up for flag officers. How is that experience, you think, going to change our culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think the notion of jointness is so excellent from the outset, you know. We know that the services have a tendency to compete with each other and to silo information and to replicate the same processes. And I think that the past 10 years have been a crucible that has put jointness into effect. And, you know, I'm a case in point. I work for an Army command half the last 2 years. And then when I went, you know, went to language school, I was in an Army base. Anybody who's done an IA with the Army from the Navy or from the Air Force has been in that environment. And now as we get ready to kind of extricate ourselves from some of that stuff and try to differentiate again, I think there will be an institutional shift away from some of the blending that we've seen, you know, because we'll try to come back around to our core competencies and trying to deliver on the thing that, you know, we're paid to do. Rather than helping out the other side. But I think it's mostly a really good thing that we've cross-pollinated so much. I think it helps me to understand what the Army goes through, and, you know, it helps the Navy to understand what the Air Force goes through, and it goes all the way around the circle. And for me to go and visit the Pentagon and see somebody, you know, from another service, I just have a lot more understanding of our commonalities and our differences. And I think for those to ascend to the highest levels of leadership, I think it'll help a lot. I was actually on staff at the Naval War College for almost 3 years. And, you know, I was just so impressed with the other services' leaders that came there. And it just brought me to a position where I said to myself, you know, I'm really proud of the Navy uniform, but if I had served in the other service, it would have been a great experience also. And I think that... that we've all had that experience through being forced into joint environments.
One of the people in the chat room asked a pretty good question, I think, which is you all were thrust into the post 9/11 world while you were at the Naval Academy, but there's at least one group that has now graduated and maybe a couple of groups who entered the Academy post 9/11, and I was wondering what your experience. Have you worked with any of the people in that age group, and do you detect any difference in their approach since they joined up for the long war in progress? Do you see any differences between your classes?
You know, I haven't really thought about that. When I see, you know, a service member, an officer, or enlisted, and I think about what motivates them, I tend to think a little bit more about what motivates them on a kind of a personal level rather than kind of the bigger picture. I mean, for myself, I was motivated with some of the bigger stuff, saying, you know, what do I want to do with my life? You know, what do I want to fight for this country? Once, you know, I think any individual, once they kind of say yes to that question and then sign the dotted line and then get into the military, then life becomes filled up with a lot of other smaller motivations for the day-to-day. You know, what do I need to do to get through this day, this week, this year? So I haven't spent the time to really think about differences between the classes. And I think the book is unique in that because we did kind of give our class an opportunity to speak on something that a lot of people might not even have thought to ask. Is, you know, what is your perspective that makes you unique? And I think for the most part, if we hadn't have asked that question, then a lot of people wouldn't have talked about it. They wouldn't have said, we have a unique perspective. In fact, I think the process of writing the book would lead a lot of us to say that, you know, we have a lot of commonalities with the classes to come after 9/11. You know, we graduated and going into war post 9/11, and then everybody who joined after that, knowing the context, I think that we share something with them. We share an understanding of the impact of 9/11. And when I think about 9/11, I think, you know, this is our Pearl Harbor. This is our JFK moment. This is something that you ask anybody who is, you know, just what they were doing on the day of 9/11. They remember, and they can kind of slow down, and they can tell the story, and they can talk about how it impacted them emotionally. And I think that it's interesting for me, because I have four kids, to have them come home from elementary school now and think they were born after 9/11, and they're being told what 9/11 was in the classroom as a historical event. And that's really interesting to me, because by the time it comes time for them to apply to college or consider a service academy or joining the military, we might have some other context entirely. And then we'll look back on, you know, graduating after 9/11 and the decade or two that followed that as being quite unique from their experience.
And just a reminder to everybody, our guest today is Graham Plaster. He is one of the four editors of the book published by Naval Institute Press, In the Shadow of Greatness, Voices in Leadership, Sacrifice, and Service for America's Longest War. And Graham, earlier in the hour, you mentioned that you're presently number two over on Amazon in the United States Navy Veterans category. Right behind the book about the SEALs, who I try not to give that guy much head time, but that's just me. But I thought what was also interesting is you are both number you and your partners and your co-writers, everybody contributed, of course. Under the Naval History, you are number one and number two. I think Amazon needs to work on their logarithm. Number one is the hardcover. Number two is the Kindle. I just thought that was just a neat stat for everybody who maybe have not heard of the book yet. Evidently, a lot of people have, and books, as you know, they pass by word of mouth. So it looks like you're definitely hitting a nerve with the book. And I wanted to do something here kind of co-related to this, is we had maybe 18 months ago, I think, we had Vice Admiral Miller from the Naval Academy on with first half of the hour. Then we had the Victor Davis Hanson on, the historian, professor, and author on. And the topic of our subject was the intellectual education of military leaders, talking about how you take young men and women and, at least from the academic point of view, try to inculcate with them an understanding of the profession at which they've chosen to do, whether it's, you know, 4 years or 40 years worth of service. And in the Navy, we have a distinct and actually codified technical bias in our education. I think it's great to debate. I think good people can debate both sides of that issue. But one thing that I saw personally in my wardroom the afternoon of 9/11 is a distinct understanding of geography, which is frightening in a wardroom to see, a distinct lack of understanding of history from both Naval Academy graduates and non-Naval Academy graduates. And while working on this book and being an FAO as you are, and looking back at your time at the Naval Academy, is there more that we can do in our academic education of officers to give them a better sense of not just their own history, but global history and how that could possibly impact the course of their career?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think there are great programs out there to supplement, the high school history education, kind of civics. I think we could do a lot better as a country to bolster those types of knowledge cores, but also in engineering. And I think what I saw at the Naval Academy as an English major, and my wife was getting her master's at St. John's next door. So as Athens and Sparta getting married, what I saw is a great engineering school. It was a great liberal arts school for certain things. I think recently they were voted as one of the number one public liberal arts schools. But there are always gaps in every education, and the question is, where are the gaps? How do we fill them in? When I was working at the Naval War College as the assistant dean of students, we said, we're going to stand up a writing center. We're going to figure out how to help our senior leaders learn how to communicate really clearly and succinctly for their papers, because a lot of them go out from their commissioning source and go out into the battlefield and do great things, and they come back around to become great thinkers and communicators. And sometimes either it's just lack of use, but, you know, some of the things that the core knowledge has to be refreshed, and some of the core competencies for communication need to be refreshed too. And so there's needs throughout the JPME pipeline for just an infusion of the core competencies, historical knowledge, communication skills, writing, and, you know, because we need to keep our engineers savvy in communication, and we need to keep our communicators savvy in engineering. So we have to remain strong on both sides.
You know, one of the chapter, I guess they're chapters, openings that impressed me was one that contained a section that reads, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, and the least dramatic moments in hindsight hold great importance in an epic story. This has been our experience. To take a humble view, we're only beginning to see the pieces come together now. The reality of warfare does not always end with a ticker tape parade. And that was followed up, among other things, with a nice piece by a young woman who's took great pride in the fact that she was able to make a physical fitness center work on a Burt class destroyer. Could you kind of discuss who did you all get together to write those chapter openings, and was that part of the theme that you all had to decide on?
Yeah, we bounced those around a lot. I played heavily with those, and some of that wording you just read is stuff that I wrote. It did get edited heavily, so I can't take full credit. But you know, what we initially envisioned was those chapter openings would be kind of they would encapsulate the theme of the chapter or the section, and then it would all help guide us as editors to try to figure out, you know, how to edit, because, like I said, we were getting stuff that was raw, you know, from people who were just writing about their experiences, and they were still kind of starting to think through what they had learned. I think the process of discussing lessons learned is so important, and this book is a 3-year lessons learned project in some ways, or maybe more than 3 years, maybe it's 13 years, you know, as we look forward from here, we're continuing to process the lessons learned. And I would say that some of the lessons learned are just not yet well-formed. You know, at this point, the different chapter openings that we've written, we're kind of trying to move us in a certain direction for a theme. We talk about kind of some of the experiences and feelings, but at the same time, I would say that we're still processing.
Graham, if I had a JO with 4 kids, one of the first things I'd ask for him, and I'd say, shipmate, you haven't deployed enough. But anyway, congratulations on your 4 kids. I've seen you've got a beautiful family, by the way, from the pics I've been able to see by cyber stalking you. And that's something else that I think the last 10 years have brought to military families is you know, the Navy is always traditionally deployed. You know, disappearing for a half a year at a time. We used to, back in the day, back when you were still a middie, we used to make little snarky comments about our Army brethren who they would talk about their, you know, 90-day hardship deployment, or the Air Force guys who at 45 days they got their deployment ribbon. But the last 10 days, that's changed a lot. We have people who deploy for over a year at a time. They're back for 6 to 8 months. They deploy again. Even our fleet sailors are looking at 10-month deployments. The family dynamic has been quite different. In the course of compiling this book and talking with people, do you think there might be an additional story out there of the experience on the home front for these people that have been in service for the last 10 years and perhaps some of the surprises that have happened in that respect?
Yeah, absolutely. We have some in there like that. I'm looking at my table of contents right now to see if I can cite some. But I remember specifically reading stories by, you know, co-military couples and families talking about some of the difficulties. My chapter talks a little bit about, just briefly, about some of the difficulties of, you know, having a family being in the military. I think, you know, from where I sit, I see guys that have done a lot of deployments. I've been fortunate. I was home for every single birth, all 4 births. So, you know, most of my classmates cannot say the same thing. So I hit the lottery. And it was a close call, especially for the second one, my captain of my first ship, Reuben James, Captain Logan Jones, really came to my aid, and he sent me home early, a week early from an exercise, so I could be there, and I was fortunate. But that's something I look back on, and I say that for me was an example of some great leadership, just looking out for your troops and your sailors. As far as the separation is concerned, I see also that some guys are in such dire situations, like as reservists, that the job isn't there at home. So they're willing to take the extra sacrifice and extend on deployment. And I've seen guys that have been deployed for multiple years at a time in order to provide for their families.
You know, the other day I had a discussion with a Navy veteran who was talking about the use of the word hero, and he thought that the people who have never served tend to overuse that expression to cover anyone who is serving or has served in any capacity. And I was trying to make the point that even the guy who's, I think, what was the, I'm not going to use Patton's familiar expression about doing something in Louisiana, but even the guy who's peeling potatoes in the galley has served and served honorably. And I thought that was one of the interesting aspects of your book, that the question of sacrifice, it is not just the sacrifice of giving up parts of your body, which is certainly more than was asked of me, but you've kind of touched on this in this book, and I want to kind of have you explore that a little bit and how you looked at the way the stories of sacrifice of all these individuals went forward.
Yeah, sacrifices. I used to tell my division and the guys I would mentor as a SWO, I'd say, look, you can pay the highest price and give your life. But you can also sacrifice your life by just grinding out, zero dark 30 to dark at night every day, and sacrificing your own personal time and your family. That's a different kind of sacrifice, and I think that telling these kind of stories does help articulate that kind of sacrifice to people who can't understand it and will never, experience it. I think sacrifice is on a spectrum, as heroism is on a spectrum, and to devalue one just really isn't essential in my mind. I don't think that you need to say that one isn't sacrifice or another one isn't heroism to value the other one more, So I think that the guy that peels potatoes, who supports the team that's working in the galley, can be heroic because he's away from his firstborn kid that's being born at this minute, and he's serving the Navy because the Navy is in harm's way, and he's a hero in my book because he works hard and he earns for his family, and he comes home and he gets his degree and he becomes an outstanding leader in his community, and it's a whole spectrum of leadership in his life, and it's valuable to our country. And then the guy that, dives on the grenade is a hero, and perhaps he's the highest and best form of the hero, but heroism is on a spectrum, and I think it's unnecessary to call one a hero and the other one not a hero. I think we can just appreciate the heroism in a different context.
You had a pretty successful rollout at the Navy Memorial. If you could, just give us your impression of that. You prep and you mentally go through what you expect to take place when you do a rollout. But did you have any takeaways from those that you had a chance to meet and see, talk to, and listen to at the rollout?
Yeah, the launch was highly successful, and we had a number of people playing a prominent role. I have to say thanks to Matt Thompson. He's a veteran and CEO of TroopSwap. .com, and he was an MBA and a friend of our network who stepped in as kind of a consultant for this event and then helped to really spearhead it. And then our publisher, Naval Institute, they're helpful in promoting it through their networks. And then all of the veteran nonprofits that we have listed on our website who were really heavily involved with promoting it to their networks. So we had just a really powerful a network of veterans leading up to our event that was we had a reach of over several, I think over 2 or 3 million people, if you, especially when you start counting the Facebook group supporting our veterans, which with Phoenix 281 was one of our nonprofits involved. He is a Facebook group of 1.7 million fans of U.S. veterans. So when we started working with our Patriot Week partners and Naval Institute and Matt Thompson at Troop Swap, we had a really effective and powerful network to put together this book launch. And on top of that, the narrative was powerful. You know, here it is, 9/11, we are at the Navy Memorial, and we're right in the middle of where it all happened. And we have a book with not just one person's experience, but 33. And in that mix, we've got, you know, fallen heroes, and we've got, you know, men and women, and we've got military and civilian. So there's just so much there to the story that really helped us. For those that showed up and actually got to experience the book launch, they went away really excited about this as more than just a book, but as a movement and as a, you know, as a community.
Earlier on, I asked you a question about the universality of the experiences that were in the book, but I want to change that a little bit to I was impressed in going through it by the breadth of experience, the number of different things that the graduates of the Naval Academy, the class of 2002, were involved in. As you were working on the book and receiving those entries, did that strike you as important and interesting?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, we had some replication of themes and overlap of themes, and that was kind of interesting to see. But we thought it was pretty valuable when we were editing down to eliminate some of the things that were telling too much of the same story. So, you know, the finished product in the book is highly diverse, and then I think it's helpful, coming back around to one of the earlier points that we touched on, is that it's helpful to bridge that cultural divide between the military and civilian worlds, because there's so little understanding of what we've been doing. So this helps to really kind of, in just a couple pages, you can see, oh, wait, the military is involved with UN peacekeeping, or the military is involved with this other aspect that I didn't realize. It's a great book to get as a gift for people who are interested to go to the Naval Academy, or parents who are, you know, getting ready to send their kids off to war, and it projects a really positive image about the impact of what our veterans do and will continue to do.
I think another feature that the people may not be aware of that I wanted to give you another chance to talk about before things wind up here at the end of the hour is the profits from the book In the Shadow of Greatness go to the U.S. Naval Academy Class of 2002 Incorporated, which is a nonprofit organization. And then I think later on this fall, you'll be sending the proceeds to other veterans-related charities. Could you talk a little bit about the foundation and where the profits will be going, and what are your goals there?
Yeah, we haven't made a dime from this book. In fact, many of our classmates invested into the project at the outset in order to get the ball rolling, and so we're several thousand dollars in as a class to make this happen. And the goal is to make money for veterans nonprofits and to get the stories out there and to be an advocate for bridging that cultural divide between civilian and military and articulating the heroism and the values of our military community. The book is, I think it's going to be pretty effective in doing that.
Well, in addition to following on in this story, and I don't know whether a 10-year anniversary is good, are there other works you're personally are working on, or you're aware of other your co-editors are working on that are along similar or at least military lines?
Well, you know, it's interesting you asked that. I was telling you at the beginning before we started that I'm getting ready to transition out of the active duty. I would love to continue writing. I think some other people who got involved with this project who didn't perceive themselves to be, you know, writers now have done it and are published and can continue to do it. We now have a network to market more stories if we want to do that. So you might see this as a springboard for other books. Who knows, maybe we'll have a book that, you know, covers the next 10 years of our experiences. And I think at that point we'll have, you know, a completely different context, different same people, different story. So it could be pretty interesting.
Another thing is, I know, especially when you have to put up any compilation of stories, and especially when you have you know, more than one editor involved in it, there's always, you know, one story that either didn't make the cut or one story you thought would be told, but when you got through the end of the day, you realize that nobody had touched on that topic. Is there something that you had to leave on the cutting room floor or that never came across the transom that kind of haunts the back of your head that you wish was included in the book?
Oh, absolutely. Every single one of them. I mean, of the 100 submissions, each person wrote because they thought, hey, this is something worth sharing with a broader audience. And it was difficult for me as an editor to leave anything on the cutting room floor because these are people that took some time to sit down and to think about what they wanted to share and write it and send it and make them feel vulnerable. So in the end, I regret cutting anybody. The ones that are going to be available in the e-version only, I'm glad that that was able to happen. And what I would like to see happen after that is to cultivate an online community talking about some of the stories and especially give place to some of the friends and family to discuss, you know, the stories and talk about how they're inspired and, you know, pull out quotes and tie things together. That'd be good. And as far as working with the nonprofits, I think, coming back around to the last question, I think that, you know, we want to partner with additional nonprofits in the future, and we don't see any end in sight for that. I think that really what we want to do is stories out there, and we want to support our veterans. So there's no reason really why we have to stop promoting the book or partnering with other veteran charities. I think in the future we'll have the opportunity to have a long roster of patriotic partners who are helping to promote the book, the stories in the book, and to raise additional money and royalties for the nonprofits.
As you look back on the experience, as you look back at that part of it, and assuming that it wasn't put in the book, is there any other advice you would give to people who were planning to enter the Naval Academy or go to Navy ROTC or some other way of joining the service that you'd like to impart right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think they should read our book. They should buy our book and buy 10 copies of our book and share with all their friends and family. And
you've got a future
everybody
in sales
should...
or politics?
Yeah, both. So, you know, I think that there were some books at the mid-store at the visitor center that I bought and I read from cover to cover as you know, a freshman in high school, and I said, this is what I want to do with my life, you know, for a certain period of my life. I want to go to the Naval Academy and I want to sacrifice some of my personal time in order to do something great. And I want to come away having achieved something and given something of myself. I think as you read the Naval Academy catalog and, you know, consider all the different opportunities of the service academies for their educational value, there needs to be a supplement to that. There needs to be something else that gives you the broader picture. And I think that our book is a great supplement to the catalog. So for a kid that's trying to understand exactly what they're getting themselves into, and for a parent that's trying to understand exactly what their kid is getting into, I think our book is great.
And on that note, we're coming towards the end of the hour, and Graham, I really appreciate you taking time to come in this afternoon to discuss the book that you were the co-editor on. And again, for everybody, the book is The Shadow of Greatness, Voices of Leadership, Sacrifice, and Service from America's Longest War, published by the United States Naval Institute Press. And I wish you the best of luck with the rest of the rollout, Graham.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate you being on the show, Graham. Thank you.
Sure.
And I want to thank everybody for joining us live or getting us on the archive. Please join us again next week for another live edition of MidRats, where our guest will be United States Naval Captain Herb Carman. Hope you have a great Navy Day.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.